I'm Martin Reeves, Chairman of the B.C. Henderson Institute. Welcome to our Thinkers and Ideas podcast, where we explore important new books and ideas in business. I'm delighted today to welcome Professor Doyne Farmer. He's a complex systems scientist and entrepreneur. He's currently director of the Complexity Economics Program at the Institute of New Economic Thinking at the Oxford Martin School. He's a professor of mathematics at Oxford, an external professor at Santa Fe, and researches a broad swathe of topics connected with complex systems. He's also a business person. He was founder of the Prediction Company, a quantitative automotive trading firm, which was sold to a bank back in 2006. And so he's not unfamiliar with business. And he's just published an exciting new book called Making Sense of Chaos, A Better Economics for a Better World, which comes out in April 2024, in which he explores the limitations of traditional economic models and talks about the analytical alternatives we can have in order to have better models and better predictions. So thanks for joining us, Doyne, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
So let me kick off with the aims of the book. I'm more familiar with your writing in terms of, you know, rigorous academic papers. You've chosen to spend a year or so writing this more popular text. What are you trying to achieve with this book?
Well, I wish it had only been a year. It's been a decade, to be honest. But I decided I needed to write a popular book because I felt it was imperative to get the basic ideas out there and more widely spread.
I see. And the first part of your book is essentially, in my view, devoted to exploring the limitations of the standard model of the economy and the finance system. Tell us about what pillars of the standard models of economics are broken and what the consequences of that are.
So the three pillars of the standard model are utility, the idea that everybody has a utility function, beliefs, everybody has some kind of model of the world, and equilibrium. In other words, supply equals demand. And in a broader strategic sense, people adjust their strategies to match what the other one is doing. So conventional mainstream economics is built on the idea that agents individually, selfishly maximize their utility, subject to their beliefs, and they assume equilibrium, and then they solve for everybody's decisions, and therefore arrive at what the economy is going to do.
Now, clearly that's a very idealistic and simple view of the economy, but is it useful?
Well, it's useful for some things. And I should stress this is not just one of the ways economists make theoretical models. It's the only way they make theoretical models. They also do statistical analysis. And I'm not really talking about that so much in the book. I'm really talking about causal models of how the world works. And, you know, it works well for some things. I would argue it works well in simple situations that are easy for all the parties to understand, where they have time to adjust what they're doing, and then you can back things out. The example I like to use is tic-tac-toe, where when I was about 10, my friends and I played a lot of it, and I figured out how to get a draw, even when I was the second player. And very quickly, all my friends figured it out, and we quit playing because it was boring. So we had discovered the Nash equilibrium for tic-tac-toe. So for some things like that, it works quite well. But when things get more complicated, as I argue in the book, it often does not work very well.
I wanted to ask you whether this view of economics as an oversimple model of the economy is a little bit of a cartoon, perhaps, because there has been a lot of attention devoted to the failures of markets, disequilibria, you know, Stiglitz and imperfect information and so on, asymmetric information. Nevertheless, even considering the, you know, the breadth of economics, you think that the models are fundamentally limited?
Yeah, I mean, to take asymmetric information, I mean, that's gotten a couple of Nobel Prizes in economics, but it's still within the same framework. There's still utility maximization. It's just that what you know is different than what I know. Market failures, you know, you can prove theorems that unless markets are complete, markets are going to fail. So that's also well known. The question is, and this is really what I focus on the book, is should we investigate other alternatives that are fundamentally different that I argue can be much more effective in more complex situations?
Now, the fundamental alternative worldview you offer is the complex systems or the complex adaptive systems view. Just before we explore that, could you perhaps explain how complex systems thinking works and how it differs from typical economic models?
Well, complex thinking spans a lot of different disciplines. And the core concept is that there are many phenomena in the world, emergent phenomena, where the building blocks are fundamentally different than the phenomenon itself. So a classic example would be consciousness. The building blocks are neurons, which are, okay, complicated cells, but they're still cells. They're not conscious. They are simple little input-output devices. Yet if you hook 85 billion of them together in the right way, we have this conversation taking place. So something qualitatively different is happening at the high level. Now, doesn't always need to be quite that fancy. I spent a lot of time studying chaotic dynamical systems where the emergence is simpler, but still quite striking. You have possibly a very simple dynamical system, a simple rule you can write down for how things evolve in time, where you get chaotic behavior, even though the rule is perfectly deterministic and very simple. And you have to look deeply into the underlying geometry to understand it, but it's quite surprising and emergent in that you can't tell a priori whether it's going to happen without actually simulating the system.
And what is it about traditional economic models that can't capture this subtlety of an economic system? You give in the book a number of, if you like, characteristic systems, and you just mentioned one, emergent behavior, another one is sensitivity to initial conditions, and chaotic behavior, and sort of endogenous behaviors, not just simple response to the environment, but some sort of internally generated behavior. So for these sorts of phenomena, why would you argue that they are characteristic of economic systems and traditional models are unable to deal with and manage those sorts of variables?
Let me maybe take those, because there's different reasons for the different things you said. Traditional equilibrium models can, under certain circumstances, generate chaotic behavior. It's just, if you take a standard macro model to first approximation, they don't. You have to put them in rather extreme situations to get that kind of behavior. And I discuss in the book why that happens. I think it's because traditional models assume too much foresight for the agents involved. The equilibrium assumption also tends to damp these things down, because in equilibrium, you're anticipating what I'm doing, I'm anticipating what you're doing, whereas in reality, often we don't do that. Now, I think more generally, the fundamental reason that traditional economics fails is because the optimization assumption puts handcuffs, puts them in a straitjacket, because it's hard to solve a model where every agent in the model is deducing their decisions in order to maximize their utility. So as soon as things get complicated, you can't do that anymore. Even with a big computer, even a, you know, the biggest computer in the world can't figure it out. I don't think this is controversial. I quote some, you know, Harvard economists to back it up. Once you have more than about 12 agents or 12 independent variables that you have to optimize, then this fails. I mean, 12 meaning a dozen, that ballpark, something like that. Now, in contrast, in complexity economics, we let agents make decisions more realistically the way they really make them, based on the information at hand, but more importantly, using simple cognitive rules to make the decisions. And that means that we can simulate systems with a million agents like that, which means that we can put in much more realistic structure for the economy. We can put in much more realistic policies that, say, a government might provide. And we can also model people in a much more realistic way. So all of those factors combine together to make the difference.
So I think, you know, you've argued very convincingly that the representation is perhaps overly simplistic. But let me ask you about the consequences. So the consequences of applying traditional economic models to the economy, is it just simply the damage due to bad predictions, or is there some sort of other consequences of using inadequate models?
Bad predictions are certainly the number one casualty, but bad predictions means lack of understanding, ultimately, because if you hand me a model and ask me if it's any good, what am I going to do? I'm going to make some predictions with a model. And if those predictions don't work very well, I'm going to say, well, I'm not sure I believe this model. You need evidence across science. Science is about making models and selecting models that we have evidence to believe are true. So as a result of this problem, the evidence for believing in macro models or most economic models is thin. So it remains debated even within mainstream economics whether the answer is this or that, because different models get constructed, their predictions are equally good or equally bad, and you can't really tell which one is right. At the end of the day, you have to have model selection to do science.
Could you give us a real life example of, you know, the catastrophic consequences, the negative consequences of using an inadequate model? I mean, you have a number of examples in the book, but which one would you pick to prove your point or illustrate your point?
Well, I would probably single out the financial crisis of 2008. COVID's another example, but some of the economic, I mean, a lot of COVID you could do with the back of the envelope. But financial crisis of 2008 was a good example where it was an endogenous failure. It wasn't a lightning bolt that struck us from outside the economic system. It was a financial system itself that generated the crisis. A few economists anticipated that we were using too much leverage and there was a potential problem and that housing markets could crash. Virtually no one predicted that the results would be so huge or even close. I mean, the best model at the Fed was off by a factor of 20. Even under the hypothetical scenario that the housing market dropped by 20%, the model predicted small consequences for the global economy in contrast to what happened, which I think would be familiar to everybody. Now, I just want to stress something. In my book, I'm not really trying to hammer on the mainstream. I'm much more trying to show the alternative than to criticize the other guys. I actually bent over backwards to be kind.
Interestingly, one group that did predict the crisis to some extent, it was the Nature paper on the fragility of the banking system. Do you remember the paper that showed the structure of the banking network and how fragile it was? And so my friend Simon Levin, the biologist, was one of the authors of that paper. And of course, biological systems are complex systems. I wanted to ask you whether you think that the discipline of biology, biological thinking, can help us in formulating an alternative worldview.
Oh, I very much think it can. This idea goes all the way back to Herbert Marshall. So I'm by no means the first to say we should incorporate more ideas from biology. But I try to demonstrate it in my book by showing in several different problems how ideas from ecology can help us understand the economic world better. And not in the biological sense, but just by mapping the concepts of biology or ecology and evolution.
So in a way, the easy part, as you've hinted at yourself, is to criticize, you know, the existing tools. So the harder challenge is to say what would be better. And you propose agent-based modeling, the approach called agent-based modeling is a better alternative, a more powerful alternative. Tell us about agent-based modeling. What is it? How does it work? And why is it better for these sorts of problems?
Agent-based modeling is just simulation when some of the things you're simulating are agents, that is, things that make decisions. So people being one of the standard examples, but it could be a firm, it could be a government, could be many possible things like that. And that poses a special problem because people are hard to understand. So once you're building an agent-based model, you have to think very carefully about the agent's model of the world. In an agent-based model, in contrast to a standard model in economics, you identify who the agents are, you identify how they interact, you find hopefully good rules for how the agents make decisions, and you put in as much institutional structure for the economy as you think you need. You always have to focus on the essential things, and then you run a simulation where you put in some information. The agents make decisions. The agents' decisions affect the economy. That generates more information, and then you repeat the loop. So you run that dynamical system forward in time, and in some cases, you discover that it goes to equilibrium as an emergent phenomenon, and in other cases, it doesn't. So it's modeling framework that's much more flexible and ultimately more powerful, though it's not necessarily simple. I mean, just think about trying to simulate the global economy, not a trivial task.
Right. And what would be the poster child of success? You give several examples in your book, including, for instance, using this approach with COVID in the UK. Tell us an example of a powerful use of agent-based modeling, which gave more accurate predictions in a complicated situation.
So you mentioned COVID. I think that's a good example. You know, when the pandemic began, I assembled sort of my dream team of my best students and postdocs, and we did an intensive push to develop an economic model that would allow us to predict the consequences of the pandemic. We thought this was a perfect test case because it was clearly an out of equilibrium phenomenon. It was a very sudden shock. And so we thought it was essential to do it out of equilibrium. And we built a model. We managed to predict what the shocks would be by understanding characteristics of the workplace, who would be able to go to work and who wouldn't. So we did a pretty good job of predicting that. We also assembled some information about what it would do to demand and, you know, which industries would be kept open regardless of anything by the government. And so we put together a simulation where we predicted the second quarter 2020 hit to UK GDP would be 21.5%. And we did this in advance of events. A couple of years later, when everything got measured properly, it came in at 22.1%. We similarly made very good predictions of what it would do to unemployment, gross output, and so forth. We made very good predictions industry by industry for 52 industries. And we even predicted the time course in the subsequent quarters quite well. We got the shape of what would happen fairly good.
It occurs to me that this may be an alternative explanation for this confusion over models. I mean, in a sense, you've talked about, you know, the veracity, the realism of the models, and that could certainly be an explanation for the persistence of poor models. But I wonder whether an alternative explanation is lack of an institutional learning loop, because how systematically or how transparently or how routinely do we go back and measure the veracity of forecasts? I mean, it's a pretty hard thing to do. If my only task in life was to compare the accuracy of your model with three other economic models, could I even gather that data? Does even such a routine or protocols exist?
In some cases, I have to say that some of the macroeconomists really do keep track of how good their forecasts are, like the guys who work at the Fed. So we do have a record of a few things. But there are many, many other situations where it's actually very difficult to track down what the model said and what happened subsequently so that you can do that exercise. In general, when people have done that, the track record has not been very good.
So I'm guessing that your book doesn't primarily deal with corporations and business, but that's, of course, our audience for this podcast. I'm guessing that you might say the same thinking, the same problems, the same choice of tools applies equally to business as the macro economy. Would you argue that?
Yes, definitely. And I am trying to create tools that businesses can use. One of my views is that the climate transition is very much, it's businesses are the ones who are actually going to make this transition. And they may make it because they're forced by the government, or they may do a lot of it spontaneously. We have the good luck that we have some remarkable technologies that are exponentially growing in deployment and costs are dropping exponentially. And so I think a good part of the transition is going to be fueled by that. And so I think if we can create tools that can guide businesses to change the narrative about climate change from being a burden that all of us have to share or a hot potato we pass around at a COP meeting to a business opportunity that the businesses who understand can exploit and make more profits from, then I think we're going to make much more progress. So we're creating a suite of tools that should help businesses do that.
So in a way, the complex systems approach and the agent-based modeling gathered a lot of attention some years ago and generated a lot of excitement. I'm thinking about the founding of Santa Fe Institute and the proliferation of commercial software tools to do agent-based modeling and so on, and also the language of, you know, emergence and complex systems. But nevertheless, it never really took hold operationally in business or seemingly in economics, judging from your book. Why is that, do you think? Is it just institutional inertia, or are there some other factors involved?
Well, in fields outside of economics, it has taken hold. It's the dominant tool that people use for doing epidemiology. Companies model their warehousing, inventory systems. Southwest Airlines models their flight system that way. So it's widespread outside of economics. Economics is harder because the agents have more agency. people are complicated, and in households in particular make decisions, it's harder to characterize what they do than it is, say, the driver of a car. Traffic management is another success story for agent-based modeling, as is battlefield simulation. It's partly about effort. You know, we broke through in epidemiology because there was a $50 million effort sponsored by the White House. Dick Cheney, actually, was the person behind it, to develop tools so that we'd understand what would happen in an anthrax event. And similarly, battlefield management, the DoD has thrown big dollars at this. Whereas in economics, we've never had big, concerted, well-funded teams. That's why I've started a company called Macrocosm, and we're trying to scale up the solutions and reduce them to practice so they can be used by businesses in day-to-day business.
I guess all models have limitations. When one uses an agent-based model, what are some of the more taxing or complex aspects of that? It strikes me, for example, that it's maybe hard to verify how we calibrate the heuristics of the agents, for example. Of course, we can say it works, but things can sometimes work for the wrong reasons or work for a while and then not work later. How do we verify and operationalize agent-based models? And what's hardest about that?
Well, it is a hard problem, and we shouldn't sweep it under the rug. It's a hard problem in economics in general. So the approach we take is to try and gather as much information as possible, put as many different stethoscopes inside the model as we can get, where we can compare what each part of the model is doing to real data. And also, by actually validating the model at the micro scale, you can often gather much, much more information than you can at the macro scale. You know, a typical macro model that, say, the Fed uses to manage the economy, if you take all the historical data that it's calibrated against and you run a compression algorithm in it, I'm willing to bet you're going to come in at about 1,000 bytes. There's just not a lot of information there. Whereas if you're really looking at the micro level of what individual households are doing, what individual firms are doing, and if you can get information at that level, then you have vastly more information to calibrate against. Another way we're trying to win in that regard is we build a model that really models 50 countries and their interactions. We have 50 times as much data by doing that.
I had an interesting conversation on the podcast last week with Gerd Gigerenzer, I'm sure you're familiar with, the grandfather of fast, frugal heuristics, and just wrote a book about intuition. And he introduced me to an idea I wasn't familiar with, which is Herbert Simon's scissors, the idea that scissors have two blades. One of them is the tool that you use to solve a problem. Another one is the problem. In other words, the approach should depend upon the environment or the parameters of the problem. So in a sense, we've been discussing what is a better model. But let me sort of reframe the question slightly, which is, what determines the choice of model according to the circumstances? Because we have other choices, right? We have sort of, you know, traditional modeling. We have agent-based modeling. We perhaps have the emergent machine learning-based approaches. We could perhaps do something with Gigerenzer's idea of intuition. So how do you think about matching the problem to the toolkit to solve the problem?
Well, I think it's a very important thing to do. I actually discuss Gerd Gigerenzer's ideas quite a bit in my book, and heuristics and our use of heuristics it's a very important thing that we put into our models. Now, I would say if you have a problem where you have vast quantities of data and where you're content to understand how things normally work, machine learning's a great tool. Been a big breakthrough. If you have, you know, a relatively simple problem where strategic thinking is the big effect, but the problem's still pretty simple, mainstream economics can do quite well. Where agent-based modeling is useful is when you have a more complicated problem, where you have priors about the world. You understand the causal structure of the system you're thinking about, so you can identify the pieces. You know something about how those pieces interact, and where you want to make predictions about counterfactual situations that you might not have encountered in the past. So those two things set it apart from machine learning. You need the prior knowledge because you don't have as much data, typically, and or you need to do counterfactual situations where you want to investigate what happens when you change the rules, where machine learning is doomed to fail because it doesn't know that you're changing those rules. It doesn't know what the rules are. Whereas in the agent-based model, you just put the rules in, you change them, and you see how it changes the behavior.
So let's assume that a strong version of your hypothesis is accepted to be true. So let's supposing that people agree with your contention that, you know, simplistic economic modeling approaches are not good enough to deal with, you know, complex problems like technology forecasting or epidemics or financial crises. And we're faced with a fairly enormous agenda, I think, aren't we, which is learning a different way of thinking, learning how to use new tools, changing all of our processes and procedures, educating a new generation on these tools and so on. If you were a CEO looking at this and saying, yes, that's right, I want to embrace complexity thinking, how would you get traction on such an agenda? Where would you begin? How would you frame that agenda?
Well, I'm not a disinterested party in answering this question because I've started a company to try and provide those kind of solutions. Now, we're not ready to provide turnkey solutions to everybody's problems yet, but we're heading that way. I would like to do, in the next decade, I want to do for economics what Google Maps did for traffic planning. That is, I want to build a tool that a business person can see themselves in the tool. Every business person should be able to see themselves in there, see what their competitors are doing, think about their markets, and understand what would happen to them if there's a change in the regulatory regime. Now, we are systematically building some milestones to get there. You know, we already have pretty much turnkey solutions for fairly simple technology forecasting, improved versions of Moore's Law, but for a wide spectrum of different technologies. We're in the process of building a agent-based model for the energy and power systems, where we're taking advantage of having a fine-grained data set that has every power plant in the world, or 90% of them. We know which companies own those power plants. We know what the costs are. We know what the profits and losses of the companies are. We have that over 30 years. We can build the model on part of it, test it on the other part, and then run it out of sample and run it forward in time. So I think this should be a great tool for people in the energy or power business, as well as governments that want to regulate it, or for that matter, even banks that are investing in energy and power or indirectly investing in fossil fuels or any other energy technology and want to be able to think about the possible crashes and problems that we could hit. I could list a few other things, but we are in the process of trying to build tools like that.
Very good. Well, unfortunately, our time is up, Doyen. Maybe I could end on a lighter note. I was looking through the endorsements for your book, and, you know, somewhat no surprise, Larry Summers and a list of economic celebrities. But I spotted that Brian Eno, I believe the musician, unless there's another Brian Eno, an economist, gave an endorsement. Is it Brian Eno, the musician? And if so, how did he come to endorse your book?
It is indeed. I have the good luck to have Brian Eno as a friend. And I wanted to try and stress that the book is, I really worked very hard to make it readable to a normal person. Now, Brian Eno is not quite a normal person, but he's not an economist, and perhaps a name people might recognize. He's a very smart, normal person, I must say. But so, yeah, I shamelessly asked him to, you know, read the book and provide an endorsement, and he graciously did. And then, by the way, though, you said it was no surprise to see Larry Summers. I was very surprised because I sent the book to Larry. I know him not well, but I know him somewhat. And since I was mentioning him in several places, I sent the book to ask him if what I said about him was okay. And he began by thanking me, saying, well, people don't actually usually send me things like that to get my approval. I appreciate it. But he then, without prompting, read the book and provided substantive feedback that actually was very helpful for me in editing the book. So I'm very proud to have such a good mainstream economist endorsing what I'm doing.
Indeed, a good omen for adoption of the ideas, I guess. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Doyen. I've been discussing Making Sense of Chaos, A Better Economics for a Better World, which comes out in April 2024 by Doyen Farmer. A very interesting book, I think, very accessible. I think we're perhaps all used to complexity science being used to tell us what's wrong with our models. But I think the really interesting thing about the book is it offers an alternative in some level of operational and tactical details. So it's not merely critical, it's a positive proposition. And I think, you know, mostly about economics, but the breadth, the application to business will be apparent. And as such, I'd strongly recommend the book. If you enjoy this conversation, make sure you're subscribed on your favorite podcast platform. And as always, we welcome your feedback.